Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. So being a lifeguard is the perfect summer job, right? You get to sit in the sun by the pool, cop some rays, but there's a lot more to it when lives are on the line. Columbus Recreation and Parks plan to open 7 public pools this summer, but there weren't enough lifeguards to open the Lincoln Pool on Ann Street on Monday as scheduled. The pool will reopen today after being closed since 2009. Is there a shortage of trained lifeguards in Central Ohio, and what kind of training does it take to be a good lifeguard? Later on, we're going to talk to the head of the lifeguard training program at OSU. Joining us now on the phone is John Gloyd, aquatics manager at Columbus Recreation and Parks, who will be opening the Lincoln Pool at 1 p.m. today. Welcome to the show, John.
Hi, how are you?
Very well. Also joining us by phone from Cincinnati is Jill Tennis. She's an aquatics coordinator for the American Red Cross of Central and Southern Ohio. Welcome to the show, Jill.
Thank you very much for having me.
To our listeners, if you have ever wanted to know anything about lifeguarding, now is the time to ask. Give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. John, what happened with the plans to reopen 7 public pools this year? There were budget cuts in 2009 that shut down 3 of the 7 until this year when the funding was restored. What happened?
Can't answer that. For sure. Once our city council approved the opening of the 3 additional pools, we started soliciting for lifeguards for this summer season. We've had it on our website and through a civil service posting since February of this year. So we did what we could to get it out there to the community. We also solicited Columbus Public School swim teams. We posted on there or sent information to their athletic directors as well as their guidance counselors to make their kids in Columbus Public Schools aware of the opportunity for the summer.
It's not the first time there have been shortages. I've written about it in the past. It seems like every year it's an annual occurrence. Are you confident that maybe there aren't some other opportunities to solicit and to get the word out?
We'll get notification of local job fairs, whether that's high school or colleges. And we normally will try to send someone to those job fair when we're aware of them. Mm-hmm. Sometimes we'll see them on the internet. Sometimes we'll see them, you know, I'll get Facebook and those types of notifications. And we try to go out to those when possible, or more importantly, when we're aware of them.
How much do lifeguards get paid by the city?
My first year guard makes $8.25 an hour.
And is that competitive? Could that be a reason that the pay is just too low?
I don't think it is at this time because that's a pretty competitive wage for the workforce when you're talking this age group.
But they do have to pay for their own training, right?
Yes, they do. If you're a Columbus Public School student, we do give them a break, and then for outside Columbus Public Schools, we do have a little bit higher rate, but it's still very affordable.
So, what do you expect to see today with the reopening of the Lincoln Pool? It couldn't happen on a better day.
Oh, absolutely. I'll be down there in a little bit just to make sure, and we've got plenty of staff on site, and we'll continue to staff it.
I'm talking with John Gloyd. He's Columbus Recreation and Parks Aquatics Manager. Also with us, Jill Tennis, Aquatics Coordinator for the American Red Cross of Greater Columbus. Jill, what's the typical job of a lifeguard these days at these public pools we're talking about?
Most lifeguards, they're there for the safety of the patrons. That's their number one priority. So it's a big responsibility. Like you said, it's not just twirling a whistle or catching some rays. They've got to go through some intensive training, not only lifeguarding skills, but CPR and first aid skills, and knowing how to use equipment, AEDs, and be ready to respond to anything at any time that could happen in and around the pool. It's not just the water also, it's around the pool too. So,
What role does the American Red Cross of Central and Southern Ohio play in training lifeguards?
We are there to help. We train the instructors a lot of times. They'll come and they'll get certified as Red Cross lifeguard instructors, and they go back and work for many local partners that we have in the Columbus area, through the city or through recreation centers, YMCAs, in the area. And they go out and they offer the training to the community in the Columbus area.
John Gloyd, it seems like maybe nobody's responding to your solicitations, but that's not necessarily the case. There's just a lot of screening that's involved too, right?
Yeah, we get plenty of job inquiries. I think what most people don't understand, and Jill hit this right on the head, that it's about a 25 to 30 hour commitment of training. And, you know, you look at a lifeguard and lifeguard chair and you think, boy, that's an easy job. The training, it's a physical training. These kids or whoever we put through training, minimum requirement is to swim 300 yards without stopping, treading water for 2 minutes.
Can you give me an idea of what 300 yards is?
In a normal pool, it's 12 laps up and back.
Okay.
You know, people think of a 300-yard walk, a 300-yard jog as nothing. When you're swimming, you're using so many more muscles. It's a tiring process. It's not something that most people can just jump in the pool, swim 300 yards and say, boy, that was easy.
Mm-hmm.
They also have to retrieve because of the physicality of possibly saving a person in deep water environment. They're required to dive into the deep part of the pool, retrieve a 10-pound brick, swim back to the edge of the pool on their back with the brick held above their chest and get out of the water. And that's a timed function. Again, this is a pretty physical job, and it's not for everyone.
Jill Tennis, are there different kinds of training for lifeguards who work at, say, lakes and in different natural bodies of water?
Yes. Yes, there are. We have work mainly the Red Cross lifeguarding program works with lifeguards that are in your standard pool water parks and like non-surf beaches, basically, is what we're working with. And there's additional training that goes along for like open water or lakefronts, and also for the water parks. So that would be, like John had said, a 25 to 30 hour course. That's an additional training if you went and worked at, you know, a local lake, or if that was guarded, or if you went and worked at a water park. So that would be additional.
John said that they help out Columbus City School students with the tuition for the classes, but what does a typical lifeguard training cost?
It varies from location and area, but I would say it's probably going to cost anywhere from $200 up to $350, depending upon where you are receiving the training and what the facility, you know, charges for the instructor's time and materials and everything. It just depends upon, you know, the specific facility.
John, that's a chunk of change, particularly for a high school student, particularly for one that might be coming from a low-income household. How much does the city help them?
City of Columbus, as I said previous, we charge $75 for a Columbus Public School mm-hmm. student, and $125 for those not involved with Columbus Public Schools.
Jill Tennis, we've been talking about a shortage that they're having problems getting enough qualified people to apply for the jobs in the first place. Is the Red Cross seeing a problem in Ohio or around the country with the shortage of lifeguards?
I don't see on a national average, the enrollment in Red Cross lifeguarding programs has steadily been increasing over the last 5 years. But I think lots of factors play into that. Pools are adding more lifeguards because they want additional surveillance of their patrons. They add water features that require additional lifeguards. If you add, you know, wading pools or slides to make it more fun to come to the pool, you have to add additional lifeguards than just watching, you know, open water. So the many pools are fully staffed, but there are areas that are having difficulty finding, you know, the lifeguards to meet the qualifications to actually get into the class and get certified.
We have an email from Sam. He writes, is lifeguarding only for high school and college students? I am a 40-year-old physical education teacher. Could I be a lifeguard as a summer job? Do you pay more since I am not a student, or would I make $8 an hour to start, too? John Gloyd, do you want to take a swat at that?
We'll take all ages. If they can pass the physical pre-test to become a lifeguard and are successful in the training, yes, we can take them. Unfortunately, the pay rate that I'm able in the city of Columbus to offer is approved by the administrators, and so I am locked into the pay rate that I can offer.
Are you satisfied, John Gloyd, that you're attracting a diverse group of people to be lifeguards for a city like Columbus?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely.
Is that a goal?
Yes. Yes. I service all areas of city of Columbus. So, again, that's why we've tried to make the fee to take the class as affordable as we can. And if there's special circumstances, we would obviously look at that.
And do you, is part of the struggle perhaps that you're competing with other recreation centers and that sort of thing? It looks, sounds like, from what Jill Tennis said, that there's a greater demand for lifeguards. Is that, and that if, do other rec centers in the suburbs, at the YMCAs, do they pay more? Do you compete on that level? Are they nicer? Are they easier to get to? Any of those issues?
Central Ohio's got a round table of aquatic professionals, and we maintain some correspondence throughout the year. And recently we just updated the lifeguard pay spreadsheet. And yes, we are comparable, competitive with the surrounding areas.
And you're, and it's easy to get around, and there's transportation is an issue for lifeguards? Because if they're, again, they might not have a car.
Most of my pools are within a block of the bus line.
Okay. All right. Well, Jill Tennis, Aquatics Coordinator for the American Red Cross of Greater Columbus, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Also, John Gloyd, Columbus Recreation and Parks Aquatics Manager. John, have fun today opening up the pool.
Can I just make one more comment?
Sure.
Not to correct you, we open at 1:30, not at 1. So
okay.
I don't want the crowds thinking they can get in right at
okay.
1. But we'll be ready for them at 1:30.
Sorry about that.
Oh, no problem.
1:30, they open up the pool. It's at Lincoln, right?
That is correct.
All right, and Ann Street. So get your towels ready.
There you go.
We'll be right back. We're going to be talking to Zach Skinner. He's Aquatics Associate Director at OSU's Department of Recreational Sports. So stay with us. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
Tom Ashbrook. Coming up on the next On Point, trillions of bacteria live in our bodies. They outnumber our human cells 10 to 1. So who's in charge? What are we? That's coming up on the next On Point from NPR.
And On Point is on this afternoon from 1 until 2 on 89.7 NPR News. Later this hour on All Sides, local Mount Everest climber almost reached the top. We'll talk with Metro Parks Director John O'Meara about his experience on Mount Everest. That's in just about 20 minutes on All Sides with Ann Fisher. 86 degrees in downtown Columbus. Sunshine today and a warm day, a high of 94. Partly cloudy tonight, a low of 71. Mostly sunny for Thursday and a high of 91 degrees. All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
Being a lifeguard is the perfect summer job. You get to sit in the sun and work on your tan. But there is more to it when lives are on the line. Today on All Sides, we're talking about a possible shortage of lifeguards in Central Ohio and how lifeguards are trained. Joining us now in the studio is Zach Skinner. He's the Associate Recreation Director for Aquatics at Ohio State University. Zach's been an American Red Cross lifeguard instructor for 13 years and has certified hundreds of lifeguards during that time. Welcome to the show, Zach.
Thank you. Good to be here.
Were you a lifeguard?
I was, absolutely.
What attracted you to it?
You know, great summer job, being outside, and many pools are inside, of course, like Ohio State as well. But I think the ability to help people is really what draws a lot of people to it.
And yet then you went on and made something of a career of it. Do you see the same sort of people being attracted to it? I keep wanting to say attracted to the sport, attracted to the job, as you did when you were growing up.
You know, I think so. There's a lot of hardworking teenagers, young adults out there, and also adults who are maybe looking for a second career, who are looking for an opportunity to contribute to the city, contribute to the university, and do something that is enjoyable and helps other people. And those are typically the people we see come in and look for the training or look for a job as a lifeguard.
And so the email from Sam, do you have very many people like Sam looking for training and looking for that kind of experience?
You know, in previous employment, when I was working in the municipal world, in a community, absolutely. And those were some of our best guards. We employed several retirees who had worked their whole life, you know, for a steel company potentially and retired and were looking for something to do. So we loved to hire those folks and they made wonderful staff members, you bet.
Is the focus on younger people, does that tend to be because the pay is so low?
You know, there's not a lot of opportunity, I guess, out there for someone to be a professional lifeguard in the Midwest or, you know, anywhere where maybe you're away from a beach in California, certainly, you know, and they're employed similar to firefighters. So opportunities don't exist a whole lot to have it be your professional career necessarily. So it's typically a part-time venture, and that tends to attract, I think, the teenagers or the young adults, excuse me, the college students.
If you're just joining us, we're talking about lifeguarding. My guest right now is Zach Skinner. He's Aquatics Associate Director at the OSU Department of Recreational Sports. If you have a question or comment, want to learn more about lifeguarding, have your own lifeguarding story to tell, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. You can also go to the All Sides with Ann Fisher Facebook page and post your question or comment there. So what do you think the requirements are for somebody even considering lifeguard training? What should they ask themselves? How should they prepare in the first place?
Well, there's a couple thoughts on that. First of all, you got to get an early start. So John, I think, had the exact correct idea and everything he's doing to try and get out in the community and hire guards. What many staff members or soon-to-be staff members, prospective lifeguards, don't realize is you got to get going early. So if you're looking for a summer lifeguard job, you really need to start thinking about it in December, January. Look at signing up for that training, applying for a job, so that you're ready to go come May or June when the pools open. That's the thing, I think, that kind of catches most people off guard.
When I was looking back at the city's training schedule, the last one ended in early June.
Gotcha. And that's very common as well, to be training people through that date. We're kind of planning, or cities, I imagine, are planning for those that are getting out of school and thinking, oh, I'd like to be a lifeguard this summer. And if cities are still in need, then absolutely they can run a class, get them trained, certified, and hired.
But he said something like 36 hours of training is involved?
It is. It's an intensive course. And honestly, there's a pretest before that will weed out several people. You'll get people for a lifeguard course that have no comfort level in the water whatsoever. Unfortunately, this job probably just isn't for them. And there are several people that try and swim that 300-yard swim that Jill was talking about. And end up swimming about 25 yards and hop out and say, I'm done. So the prerequisites that are there are very good and they're there for a purpose. But it's an intensive training.
They tend to be athletes in water sports, whether it's water polo or the swim team or something like that?
They tend to be very comfortable swimmers, I'll say that. They actually don't need to be an athlete, and if we only hired athletes who had, you know, a professional or a, you know, competitive swimming background, we would be severely short lifeguards. So just someone who's very comfortable in water, probably someone who took some lessons growing up, who knows some fundamentals about the different strokes, who can, you know, swim back and forth across the pool several times without getting winded.
What takes place during that training? What exactly are they? What do you do during that time?
You know, the training covers a lot, but you know, the professionalism of a lifeguard, certainly safety around the pool, CPR, AED is included there. There's some first aid in there as well. And then the lifeguard course is made up of what to do in certain situations. If you see an active drowning victim, someone who's in the pool and struggling or can't get to the edge, or a distressed swimmer, what do you do in that scenario? How do you get them to the side without putting your own life in danger? And then, of course, it handles all the more serious emergencies, too. If you're to have some type of a spinal injury, putting a victim on a backboard, getting them out of the pool without causing further damage to them. Working with our EMS services to make sure that they get evac'd really quick. So it's a very complete course.
How do you teach someone the ability to see a problem amid the chaos of a typical day at a typical pool with the typical screaming kids?
That is an excellent question. And that's actually a large portion of the course, is that scanning and surveillance. So lifeguards are taught several tricks, but it can be as simple as counting patrons or counting customers in certain areas of the pool, always keeping your head moving, making sure that you're recognizing factors that could distract you, intrusion of other duties, failure to recognize, you know, a potential drowning victim. So scanning and surveillance is a big part of the course that they really hone in on.
When you talk about scanning and counting heads, is that so that you're forced to look at each head to make sure that it's bobbing where it should be and how it should be?
It is, and it's to ensure that you're not, you know, looking at someone laying down on a beach towel on the side, or staring into space, or watching one activity too intently. Your time really needs to be divided pretty equally in between the different edges of the pool, the different corners, the different areas, you know, making sure to look at those hard-to-see spots. If there's an activity, diving or a slide close, making sure that that may be a high-risk element, so keeping your eyes on that. But basically, your head and eyes should always be moving, rotating back and forth, actively scanning the pool.
Do you look for a certain personality, or should I say, maybe I can talk about this differently? Do you ever look at somebody that's maybe just not suited personality-wise or temperament-wise for the job and eliminate them that way?
You know, most lifeguards will go through an interview process, you know, with virtually any employer, and that will include some hard skills, so jumping in the water, and if you're coming in with a certification, making sure that you can do the hard skills and get people out of the water and perform all the rescues safely and appropriately. But, you know, in any interview process, probably for any job, there's the soft skills that most employers are looking for as well, and customer service is a big one of those. Everybody kind of, you know, there's been multiple SNL skits and skits on many shows about lifeguards and how they enforce rules and are quite serious about it. At the end of the day, they're trying to keep everybody safe. But I think the hope of every employer of lifeguards is that they're doing that with as much customer service. There are rules to follow. Yes, we need to enforce them, but we want to be as friendly. We want to help the little ones out. We want to make sure that we're communicating why a rule is in place, not just that there is a rule and you need to follow it. So customer service is important.
When I was taking driver's ed, I remember back in the olden days, they'd show you a film strip of a horrible car accident. And I was wondering if, to what extent, the disaster is part of the training and seeing a disaster and the aftermath.
Yeah, and that's a philosophy question, I think, for the employer. The American Red Cross has wonderful videos that accompany their training, and those are not focused on, you know, the kind of gory disaster element side of it. There are training utensils out there and training videos out there that many employers, you know, show their staff, and there's some that are very good, and they will show an actual surveillance video of, you know, a drowning that took place. You know, and it kind of starts a clock, and you see how long it took for, you know, maybe a lifeguard to recognize it and go ahead and activate EMS, get them out, and start care on them. So there's different training tools out there. And again, I think that's kind of a philosophy question as far as the employer goes and how they're trying to train their staff and whether it's beneficial for their environment or not.
What else do lifeguards do? Do they, at typical pools, you know, at a community pool, is it that all they do is they're sitting up there on that bench, or are there other things that they are asked to do for their pay?
They have a many, many, many job duties. Sitting on a chair and scanning the pool is probably, you know, risk-wise, certainly the most important. But they are also cleaners, and they are big cleaners. I can speak for Ohio State. And by all means, our lifeguards are always either tearing something down, setting something up, moving lane lines, moving bulkheads, moving flags, cleaning. We do all of our own cleaning at the Ohio State University RPAC Aquatic Center. And so they are always busy. And in fact, especially in an outdoor environment, those guards should not be up there for a four-hour shift because it is virtually impossible to sit there and actively scan the water for four straight hours or even 1 hour. So part of the plan and part of the program is that you are putting them in that environment and then taking them out and having them rotate every 15 to 30 minutes so that you're ensuring you've got a fresh set of eyes and a fresh mind up there watching bodies and watching swimmers.
Tim in Clintonville, you're on the air. Welcome to the show, Tim.
Yes, I have a quick question and also a comment, I guess. We frequent the Tuttle Pool here, one of the public pools here. We were there last year with a group of friends, and one of the young girls that was with us said that she was asked by some representative of the pool to pretend to be a distressed swimmer. And I'm wondering, first of all, if that's accurate, and if so, if that's part of the training that, ongoing training, and if there are other things that the lifeguards are doing ongoing.
That I certainly can't speak for that organization or that pool, but it's referred to as a red alert drill or a red cap drill, and yes, it is something that's used in many municipalities, many collegiate scenarios. But basically, we're testing that lifeguard. We want to let everybody on deck know that this is just a drill, and typically that's done. But we have used real victims or real not real but real people, I guess, to act as a victim. And the goal is for that lifeguard to recognize the incident, immediately, hop in, because they don't necessarily know that it is a drill. Hop in, make the save, hop out, and then be evaluated on that. And we found over time that that absolutely improves a lifeguard's scanning surveillance skills. They know that could be coming at any time. It also reinsures that lifeguard that, look, if this situation is presented to me, I'm able to adequately respond, and I won't freeze up. I'm not going to get nervous and forget what to do. It kind of hardens those skills and brings those skills out. So they're a lot easier to do in a real situation.
What about ongoing training and continuing education maybe is a better way to look at it? Once you pass the test and once you get the job, are you set for life? Or
once you pass the test, you get the job. Typically, there's a lot of company or municipality or pool specific training that needs to take place. Every pool is unique. The certification you get doesn't really equip you to guard at that particular facility. You need to really go through additional training when hired at that facility, or at least in my opinion, you do. And I think that's pretty commonplace. Additionally, there's in-services that take place. At The Ohio State University, we have multiple in-services each semester for staff to come back, not only go through their hard skills, but also, catch up on paperwork, do some swimming, get in the pool, and make sure that they are just as good as they were when we hired them. So absolutely, it's a critical component of it.
But is a lifeguard certification, is that good for forever, or do you need to be recertified?
It'll be good for 2 years.
Okay.
Yep.
All right. Thanks, Tim.
Am I still there?
Yeah.
No. Okay. Just one quick comment. Just going back to the earlier part of your show, it seems to me that, municipalities tend to find the money for the things that they find most important, and I know that money's tight, and that's unfortunate. While it's good that, some of the city pools have opened, there were just a very few open in the last couple of years. I hope that there's money to be found for that to continue to happen, because depending on what part of the city that it's in, there are a few opportunities to go to a pool. So if it's possible in any way for that money to be found, that would be wonderful. Thank you.
Yep. Thank you, Tim. Take care. Steve in Upper Arlington, you're on the air. Welcome to the show, Steve.
Hey, Ann. I just was at the Upper Arlington pool yesterday, and I saw a poster that Upper Arlington is actively recruiting older lifeguards this summer because OSU is switching to semesters, and they're concerned that they're not going to have enough lifeguards since they'll be going back to school early. And part of the deal is you get a free pool pass, and I think you get your training free, too. I'm not sure about that, but...
And we have spoken with Upper Arlington and their partners. In fact, we love to partner with the entire community, but we have spoken to folks there, and they have conveyed to us their concern about this, and we're committed to helping them out, and we have conveyed that to them as well. So it's a great partnership. All of the Columbus lifeguard employers or Columbus pools all work together pretty well.
All right, Steve, thanks for that.
Great. Bye-bye.
Take care. We have from Sue on Facebook. She writes, my daughter was a lifeguard for 2 summers of high school and then 1 summer during college. She said the worst part of the job were the parents who did not pay attention to their kids. She said she felt like a makeshift parent most days, yelling at the same kids day after day. She eventually quit because she said it wasn't worth the aggravation. Good point.
It's very interesting. And in a public pool, a municipal setting, you know, there's many situations where kids and even very young kids can be dropped off at the pool and then left. And I think that's something that, you know, the industry needs to kind of look at and stay vigilant on. But what is the duty of these lifeguards? Are they there to necessarily babysit the kids and take care of the kids? There is a component of that in their job. But the more time they're spending doing that without a parent there to maybe correct the minor behaviors that, you know, could be unsafe, the less time they have to be doing, you know, the scanning, the surveillance, the watching the pool to make sure that nothing serious is happening. So that's been a longstanding discussion and debate in the industry as far as what a lifeguard's role is.
And what's the resolution? I mean, parents have to be there with their kids at a certain age or younger?
Yeah, and again, it varies depending on which pool you go to, but most pools will have an age cutoff. You know, and I couldn't speak for any of the Columbus area pools, but an age at which point, you know, maybe 6 and under, that parent needs to be within arm's reach of the child. 7 to 9, they may need to be in the facility with the child, but not necessarily right next to them. And then 10 and above, they can drop and go. So, you know, again, that is just one example. But the idea is that we really want these lifeguards scanning and keeping people safe and keeping people from drowning or from, you know, injuring themselves. And so the less time they spend, you know, correcting little behavior issues, the more time they have to do their serious job.
You've been at this for about 13 years now, training. What has anything changed? Are they better trained now than they were back in the day, or has it always been pretty much the same?
Things always change, I will tell you. Jill could vouch from the Red Cross that the Red Cross rolls out a new program about every 4 years.
Okay.
They're very good at using data that they've learned from the last 4 years to roll out their new program. And so there have been many changes in how they're trained. You know, I think the training has always been quality, though. It's always been great. The American Red Cross has been a great partner everywhere I've worked, not just at OSU, but everywhere else. And it's been consistently good. You know, techniques change, prerequisites change, the pre-course changes, the material changes, the video changes. But I think that I can say very confidently that the material's always been good and it's always been sound, and changes that they've made for the most part have been very, very, very sound as far as the decisions.
Well, Zach Skinner, thanks for joining us today to talk about it.
Absolutely. Thank you.
Zach Skinner, Aquatics Associate Director at the OSU Department of Recreational Sports. Coming up, we're going to hear about an attempted we're going to hear from John O'Meara, executive director of Metro Parks, and who attempted a climb of Mount Everest this spring. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
On the next Fresh Air, Jeff Daniels talks about starring as a cable news anchor in the new HBO series, The Newsroom. It was created by Aaron Sorkin, who also created The West Wing. Join us for the next Fresh Air.
And Fresh Air begins in 20 minutes, starting at noon on 89.7 NPR News. If you contributed to our station this year, thank you. Your support provides for the highest quality news and information. Our fiscal year ends on June 30th, and we still have about $50,000 to raise to meet our annual goal. If you wish to make an additional gift or fulfill your current gift, you can do so right now at WOSU.org or by calling 1-866-897-9678. And thank you for supporting 89.7 NPR News.
Support for 89.7 comes from Montgomery & Associates, a private wealth advisory practice of Ameriprise Financial Services, offering perspective in a time of economic uncertainty to help grow and maintain wealth. Details at themontgomerysolution.com.
88 degrees in downtown Columbus, sunny skies today, a high of 94. Partly cloudy tonight, a low of 71. More sunshine and highs in the 90s again on Thursday. And there's a chance of rain Thursday night. All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
About 60 years ago on Queen Elizabeth's coronation day, May 29th, two members of the 9th British Expedition reached the summit of Mount Everest, the highest point on Earth. They were the first. Many, many more have followed now. Joining us now is John O'Meara. He served as executive director of Metro Parks since 1998. And back in March, we talked with John as he was about to leave for his first trip to Mount Everest. He almost reached the top, but had to turn back because of illness. Four climbers died on their way down from the top of Mount Everest last month. Fortunately, all the members of John O'Meara's expedition made it back safely, but we were wondering around him about him when we heard about those the four dead. So we welcome him back to All Sides, John O'Meara.
Good to be back. Thank you.
So there were no necessarily problems actually getting to the base, or were there? I mean, was that pretty ordinary?
Well, I don't know. Ordinary is the right word. You walk for 10 days from where the plane drops you off, and you're walking on a path that's been used for thousands of years as a trading route between what's now Nepal and Tibet. So it's very culturally interesting. It's not a terribly difficult struggle. I guess there was one instance that like caught some people's attention. I did get somewhat attacked by a yak along the way, and fortunately he didn't actually gore me, but I did get a good bump from the yak, and he tore my backpack off. So
that yak was that, the big horns.
Yeah. It looks like a big cow.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, it was they use the same route for trade, because that's the only it's everything carried by people or by yaks. There's no vehicles on those. There's no roads per se in that part of Nepal.
And when you arrived and you were getting ready to start climbing, were you already sick by then?
No, I was fine. I was over there for 2 months.
Right.
And so for the first 8 weeks, I was fine. Almost everybody gets something that they just refer to as a Khumbu cough. And the Khumbu is the name of the region. It's the Khumbu region in Nepal. And everybody at the altitude, because you're breathing lots of cold, dry air for extended periods, and people get, coughs all the time up there. So I had some of that earlier on, but generally I was fine until, the week before, actually three people in my team got bronchitis, and one of them actually headed back down to lower elevation to get some, have a better chance of recovering. The others two just relied. They just a couple of days before we headed up, went to the doctors or our doctors at base camp, and got some antibiotics. But I was feeling fine at that point, so kind of knew where the germs came from. But they didn't really hit me till the day we started up the final push up the mountain.
How far up were you by that point?
When
you started that final push,
Base camp is at about 17,500 feet elevation, so it's higher than any of the Rockies out west. So it's up there, starting that point, and then we walked the first day from there, and that final push up, you go up to camp two, which is at about 22,500, and we actually spent two nights at camp two, and then we went up to camp three, which was about 24,000 feet.
And when you talk about your group that you were with, how many people are in your group? Where were they from?
There were eight in the immediate group. There were actually 11 clients, if you will, that were all traveling together. So eight of us in what was called the hybrid team, and there were three who had private guides who were also with us. And then, when you counted all the Sherpas and support staff, there was quite a bit more. But there were 11 climbers in the group.
And of those, was everyone as experienced as you are?
Actually, it was a very experienced group. The company I went with does, in fact, check out people's backgrounds, make sure they have reasonably good experience, reasonably good chance. And I actually thought everybody in the group, both physically and previous experience, had the ability to make it to the summit. They were a good team.
How did you know at what point then that you maybe did you delay going up at first, or did you just have to make a decision not to go at all when it was time to go?
Everybody had waited. The season was such this year that, in fact, May 18th was the first day anybody got up, and that was really just the people setting the final lines, safety lines to the top. May 19th was going to be the first day that any of the climbers were really going to get up there. So it was between a combination of some hazards and the weather this year. And that's not unusual. I mean, it was a fairly short period. So May 19th was the first day, and I think May 29th was the last day anybody could summit this year. So it's a fairly short window because of the weather. So when you finally get the right weather, yes, everybody moves at the same time, which creates some of the lines that you heard about. But that's an annual event. That's not something new that happened this year. So when the time came to go up, there was no doubt it was time to start moving up the mountain and get in position for the summit.
Or turn around and go back. My guest is John O'Meara. He's executive director of Metro Parks. We're talking about his attempted climb to the summit of Mount Everest, the highest point on Earth. If you have a question or comment for him, give us a call, 614-292-8513. You can also email us at allsides@wosu.org. You can go to our Facebook page, or you can tweet me at @AnnFisherWOSU. Four climbers died on their way down from the top, from the summit last month. What did you know about that and what happened with them?
You know, we knew some. Actually, there were a lot more deaths. There were, I think, 10 deaths this year. I think the media reported
the
four that occurred on one day.
Okay.
Which kind of caught the attention. But by that point, five other folks had already passed away. Four of those first five were Sherpas who were kind of getting things. So they were, and I found that a little bit disturbing that they weren't on, you know, if you're going to give coverage, why not coverage to everybody?
Right,
but they
absolutely
kind of ignored the Sherpa deaths. And and so there were quite a few deaths this year. But there are some every year up there. It's a very dangerous place.
And yet so many people do it. And I was really struck by some of the photographs I saw of the lines. It did look like a traffic jam. We talked about that when you were on a few months ago beforehand. But is that really just the way it is now in places like that? And there's no... Isn't there any way to control it, or would that not be fair?
You know, it's probably not a good way to control it. This is important to the economy in Nepal. Nepal wants all these visitors coming in, paying money, buying the permit, so forth. Similar on the Tibet side, they're not as, you know, China's not as necessarily relying on the income from the climbers. But in both cases, they're looking for the income, so they're trying to get the people there. There's only one safety line going up. Everybody gets on that safety line in the the technically difficult areas, and all you need is one person ahead of you who's slow for any reason, and it'll create a traffic jam.
If you had to go back, and if you, it's not something that you can necessarily do lightly. It's not the idea like I'll try again next year, right? It's pretty expensive.
It's expensive. It's a lot of time away from home and work, and so yes, it is something that's taken lightly.
And how long had you been preparing for it again?
You know, I got serious a couple of years beforehand. So the last 2 years, really, I was working hard to be ready.
So when it got to that point to make the decision, did you make the decision yourself, or did somebody talk with you about it? And how do you come about get to that point?
Yeah, the guides heard me coughing. I was coughing up lots of nasty stuff. And then they heard that in the tent at night. At that time, I was still saying, boy, all I really need is a good decongestant. But I also knew in my own mind that was way too much lung problems. Lung problems up high in the mountain do kill people, and that's the practical reality. And pulmonary edema is a very serious thing that affects the lungs that people get up there. I wasn't sure if it was starting pulmonary edema or not, but I knew I was coughing an awful lot. The guides heard it. They came over, and they put an oxygen meter on my hand just to see my blood oxygen level was. And it was like 52%, which is way too low. Even on the mountain, and the mountain's slower than it is. If there's doctors listening, they probably thought, should be dead at that. But on the mountains, down to about 70% is okay at that altitude. So I was well below a safe level of oxygen. And I was on supplemental oxygen already. I was in bed laying on supplemental oxygen, my oxygen level, because I wasn't able to get oxygen through my lungs, into my lungs.
So could you have physically have done it anyways?
No. I don't believe so. I think I probably would have been one of the statistics if I tried to go up at that point. My lungs were clearly, they're badly congested, and starting to show some early signs of pulmonary edema, which is clearly a killer up there.
And getting down at that point, did you wait to leave? Did you have to do something quick? Because you're very sick. So
I was very sick. They gave me medicine right away. They upped the amount of oxygen because I was on oxygen. I was on a low level. I was just laying in bed. Had just turned it on that day when I got. That was the first time I used any. They turned it up much higher, and we left early in the morning. Early in the following morning, we got up and started making our way down what's called the Lhotse face. It's a big cliff from between Camp 2 and Camp 3.
And did you have help, or did you need help?
I had a Sherpa who was with me, and it was very helpful because I, Because I was short of oxygen, I wasn't thinking clearly. So the Sherpa was making sure all my safety devices were properly hooked up at the proper time. So it was very helpful. There was also a guide who came down at the same time.
Did the fact that those other four people died in one day, did that have an influence on you at all?
I don't know that it did. It's unfortunate. We certainly all worry about it. Everybody wants to try to prevent deaths in that situation, but everybody also knows that, you know, it's probably going to happen to somebody. You know, unfortunately, people get what's often referred to as summit fever. You know, going back to what we said, you spend a lot of time preparing, a lot of money, an awful lot has gone into this point. They can see the summit. We could clearly see the summit from Camp 3. It's just there. I would have been on the summit the very next day if I had been able to continue. And a lot of people see that, and even though they're getting sick, they unfortunately oftentimes ignore either their own wisdom or the, you know, their guides or their Sherpas or other people that are with them saying, time to turn around. They say, no, I've got to keep going. So that contributes oftentimes to the problems up there.
To what extent can the guides say, no, I'm not letting you go?
You know, you're not actually on a rope with the guide. Mm-hmm. If you say you're going to keep going, they can't really stop you. That's part of the reality up there. You're not access. This is not some other mountains you're actually roped to the guides. In this case, you're not. You're typically roped to a Sherpa, one of the local experts, and that's it. Well, actually, and even up high in the mountain, you're not roped to anybody. You're tying into that rope that crawls the traffic jam. So you're climbing into the safety rope that's there, but you're not roped to another person.
What happens, and I don't know if this is a case in other climbs you've done where there are those kind of traffic jams, is that just specific to Mount Everest, or can that happen in other places as well?
It happens in other places. It happened to a lesser degree when I was on Aconcagua. Aconcagua is the highest mountain in South America. It's down in the Andes. And on summit day, we got up, and we were probably 300 feet below the summit, and we were sitting there waiting for some climbers ahead of us who were obviously struggling on a section where, it was a narrow section of trail, cliff up in one direction, cliff down the other, and you basically had to wait until they got to some place where we could pass them.
Is there an etiquette at that point where that's part of what you have to do, or do people get angry? I mean, talk about the summit fever. Do some people freak out sometimes?
There's not an agreement on the etiquette, and all the big mountains are climbed by people from all over the world, mm-hmm. and people in different parts of the world look at it differently than, you know, Americans. I think typically think in terms of, well, slow climber, get out of the way, let the other people pass. The other people, the culture is very different in other places of the world, and other people think you just wait your turn, and if somebody's slower, well, that's unfortunate, but they also paid a lot of money and spent a lot of time preparing, and whether or not they're adequately prepared is one of the big questions that always comes up. There's always that, you know, at least people would think that there's lots of folks on the mountain who shouldn't be up there, but even good climbers get sick, get slowed down by altitude problems, so lots of reasons people slow down.
So in retrospect, how are you feeling about the whole experience?
Oh, it was a grand experience. It really was a great adventure, you know, wonderful cultural experience, seeing, you know, the trekking parts of the trip where you're seeing all these centuries of human history kind of laid out before you. And the mountain itself is generally pretty clean. I mean, there was a point where people left a lot of trash, but you know, several years ago, several of the big outdoor companies paid to have a bunch of it removed. And even then, things like the oxygen bottles that were left behind, they're right. Valuable now for recycling. Nobody's leaving them up there. So there's still a little bit of trash buried in the rocks at base camp. You saw some of that. But the stuff on the surface is all pretty much been cleaned up.
And the people you meet?
They're fascinating. Really, you know, it's a global experience. You're climbing with people from all over the world and spending a lot of time in Nepal and getting to know the people there a little better. And so, yeah, it's a fabulous cultural experience as well as the challenge and the adventure. It's a very challenging climb.
Where were some of the people from that you were with?
In our team, there were one was from Finland, one from Ireland, one from Saudi Arabia. There two of the people had both Irish and American passports, so I don't know if you call them Irish or Americans, but I think they called themselves Americans. you know, in the larger group we were with, there were people from India, people from Iran, people from Germany. So I'd have to think. So this is just our own company's
right.
team that got to know. And as you're meeting other people on the mountain, there are far more Asians climbing than there are Americans. So whether India, Korea, Japan, Chinese.
There's just far more Asians.
There's far more Asians, which explains a lot of that. That's correct.
Right. Well, could you have prepared any other way than you did?
I think I was physically, mentally prepared. I think I was good. You know, in hindsight, the one thing, that when the other two team members went to get the antibiotics 2 days ahead of time, I should have just gone with them, got the antibiotics. I didn't feel like I needed them at the time, but clearly something was going to hit me a couple. Take a precautionary. I think that would have, because otherwise I was doing well. I felt good. I think I was prepared to make it to the summit, but obviously the body didn't agree at the right time.
Well, I'm really sorry, but I'm glad you're back with us and well and healthy.
Well, thank you.
Any trips planned?
I don't have any plan. That's unfortunate. I usually have some goal in mind that keeps me motivated. Right now, I don't have anything planned. My wife and son are actually leaving for Mount Rainier later this week.
Mm-hmm.
That was helpful. In fact, I've come back and obviously to help them get ready. I've been out hiking and doing some other things to help them get ready, and that's helped me get back into the exercise that I need to do to stay healthy.
But no vacation left.
No vacation left. That's correct, which is why I'm not going with them.
Well, John O'Meara, thanks so much for joining us today to talk about your trip.
You're welcome.
John O'Meara, Executive Director of Metro Parks. He tried and didn't quite make it to the summit of Mount Everest this spring. Thanks for listening. I want to thank the All Sides staff as well. Producer Linda Taylor, Associate Producer Amy Jurovich, All Sides intern Corinne Gleckler, All Sides volunteers Rachel Ramey and Andrew Sweet, with video production by Rich and Amber Karsmiski. Alan DeCenzo is the composer of our theme music. WOSU News and Public Affairs Director Mike Thompson. Radio Operations Director Kevin Petrilla. Senior Broadcast Technician Eric French. You can listen back to today's shows and every show by visiting WOSU.org/allsides. Explore the All Sides archive, where you can find more information, links, and audio and video of every show. Also, be sure to like All Sides with Ann Fisher on Facebook and follow me, Ann, on Twitter at AnnFisherWOSU. Thanks for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher. This is WOSU 89.7 and WOSU HD1 Columbus, streaming online at WOSU.org. 89.7 NPR News, a service of WOSU Public Media.
Support for 89.7 comes from OSU's John Glenn School of Public Affairs, offering continuing education and graduate degree programs designed for the working professional. More information at glenn.osu.edu.